Lots of people celebrate the great spaces of the outdoors. Few people celebrate them in words and pictures as prolifically as Tim Palmer. Tim lives in Port Orford on the southern Oregon coast, but we can guess that there are lots of times he's not home because he's working on projects like his latest solo book, Rivers of Oregon. He is also the photographer for a book by Char Miller called America's Great National Forests, Wildernesses, and Grasslands. Tim Palmer may be the luckiest person alive. He gets to visit the beautiful outdoor places of our country and document them so others can enjoy them as he has. He has now up to 24 books about rivers, the landscape, and adventure travel, and he's won awards for his work through the years. Tim Palmer, always a pleasure to have you on The Exchange.
Hi, Jeffrey. It's great to be with you. I am a lucky guy, and I'm lucky to be here with you today.
All right. Always good to have you. Talk about these particular books. I'm surprised there was not a Rivers of Oregon sooner, given that there is a Rivers of California and a Rivers of America, for example.
Yeah. Several years ago, I wrote somewhat a companion volume called A Field Guide to Oregon Rivers, which is a handy little pocket guide full of tips on where to go for the best fishing and boating and hiking along rivers. But in doing that, and the book's been really successful and wonderful, people love it, but in doing that, I realized that, gosh, the rivers of Oregon really deserve a photo book that's more evocative of the beauty and the importance that these places have to all of us, along with the text of how Oregonians have been such models of conservation activity in regard to those rivers. So I launched this other project, and it's a new book now, just out this fall, by Oregon State University Press called Rivers of Oregon. And I'll be in Ashland talking about it on Monday.
Okay, where's that going to be?
It's going to be at the Standing Stone Brewery on a good little location at 6 p.m. on this coming Monday, October 17th.
Okay, good to know. Coming back to the discussion of the field guides in which you indicated the best places for fishing, boating, and hiking, do you have to do all of those yourself to make sure that you know what you're speaking to?
Oh, I just have to. That was the coolest thing about that book. I did get out a lot over a period of several years, exploring and checking things out. And I guess that's really the thing that makes me the luckiest guy. But, I still spend most of my time in front of the computer working on the books. But yes, I definitely got out to boat our rivers and to hike along them and bike along them. And I especially made a point of doing the long river trips that Oregon offers. We actually have 10 of them of nearly 100 miles or more without a dam or major rapids that would kind of stop your progress. And that's more than any other state. So I was really fortunate in being able to spend time there.
Have you done the Rogue since Gold Ray Dam came out and lengthened?
Yeah. My wife and I, not this summer, but last summer, did a fabulous trip the whole way. Years ago, we did the longest Rogue trip you could do without a dam, which was Savage Rapids out to the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
That was 1993. Of course, they took out Savage Rapids Dam and then the several dams above that, so that now instead of about a 100-mile or so trip, you can do a trip of nearly 160 miles. So it's one of those great, long, extended river trips possible in the West, yet very few people do the whole thing. Most people, of course, do the wild sections, about 32 miles. But hey, here's 160 miles of great river. So we put in at Lost Creek Dam, right there where the water is released, and we went to the ocean, and it was fabulous.
Wow, how many days?
15.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to take that many, but we loved it. We would have spent more if we could. But yeah, it's just a great trip. It shows the whole Rogue, really, the wilderness section shows that great wilderness section. But the whole Rogue shows headwaters and a community river through the Rogue Valley and then the wild section. And then it cuts the whole way through the Coast Range, and you go right out almost to the ocean itself. So, it really ties together the ecosystems and the diversity and the beauty of Oregon, all in one river trip. And, of course, it's in our backyard here in southern Oregon.
We've been talking about the Rivers of Oregon, your new solo book, but there's also America's Great National Forests, Wildernesses, and Grasslands. The author is Char Miller, the photography by you. How did that project come about?
Well, this was another really fortunate thing for me, and I hope others. A friend named Scott Tilden actually wasn't a friend until the book, but he now is. He got this idea for a book about national forests. He actually saw the Ken Burns TV series on national parks, and he says, hey, there should be a book about national forests that's modern and up-to-date and evocative of this amazing public estate. So he got me as the photographer, and Char, who's an eminent Western historian who teaches at Pomona College in New York, in California, and to write it. And so we went to work here a couple of years ago, and I had the enviable job of photographing national forests nationwide. I also ended up writing and this was really a really fun part of the project. I got to write the introductions to each of the chapters, because while Char is this fabulous historian, he hadn't really been everywhere, and I sort of have, and so. So I got to write the kind of to create the sort of physical presence of each region as the opening of each chapter.
We'll talk more about the work of Tim Palmer coming up in just a few minutes here on the Jefferson Exchange. Standing next to him is kind of sort of like taking a breath of the fresh outdoors, because he's always out there, out in that himself. We'll come back and talk more about Rivers of Oregon, the other book, America's Great National Forests, Wildernesses and Grasslands, and about wild spaces and their care and feeding in general when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Tim Palmer from Port Orford once again. Tim is so prolific. We keep having him on because he keeps writing books. He's up to 24 now, and I'll have to ask him if that includes the two sitting in front of me now, Rivers of Oregon, which is a solo work by Tim Palmer, really a photographic exaltation of some of the great rivers in the state of Oregon. And he is also the photographer for a book by Char Miller called America's Great National Forests, Wildernesses, and Grasslands. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about wild spaces and their maintenance. And their creation, for that matter. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Tim, when we say 24 books, does that include these two, or are we up to 26 now?
Yeah. I think it does, Jeffrey. Yeah.
You've lost count, haven't you?
Yeah, let's say plus or minus one, maybe.
So you mentioned being at the computer a lot. I'm probably giving you more credit for being outdoors than you're saying is due, but is there always a next project? It seems like you're always moving from one thing to the next.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, I love the project I'm on, but I can't wait to launch the new one. And right now, that is a book about the wild and scenic river system, whose 50th anniversary is in 2018. So I have a book about national wild and scenic rivers nationwide coming out next fall by Oregon State University Press.
All right. That sounds like a good place to take in a call from Harvey in Brookings, I think, wants to talk about something very much like that. Hi, Harvey. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer.
Hey, good morning. This is Harvey. Hello, Tim.
Yes.
So I really appreciate your doing this show today, and I've followed you before, and I've seen some of your wonderful books. And my question is, I'm a fishing guide in wild spaces, wild rivers, and I spent my lifetime guiding in those places, Selway Bitterroot Wilderness Area, what used to be called the Idaho Primitive Area, now the Frank Church Wilderness. And I went to a meeting last weekend, about 2 weeks ago. It was kind of disturbing, where the Farm Bureau gets really concerned, and they raise, you know, it's a big national organization, and they raise these questions, some of them false, about securing water rights. And, you know, how can I best justify talking to those people and make a difference with those people, that large group that, you know, lobbies in Congress? I would really like to let Congress know and the people know that I have a sustainable, a viable economic interest in the public lands as they are, not really change them and strip out the water.
All right. Yeah, thanks for that, Harvey.
Yeah, this must be Harvey Young, the notorious fishing guy.
Notorious fishing guy.
Anyway, Good question, Harvey. The how do you deal with groups and people who have a different view on whether or not our water should be protected in certain ways? The of course, the main thing you need to do is to check in with the agencies and the elected officials making the decisions and make your view known to them. But I think it's a really good idea to try to touch base with these groups and people themselves. You know, one of the problems in America today is we're so polarized, and the opposite sides don't even talk to each other. So, for example, the Farm Bureau has taken issue with the setting aside water rights in the North Fork of the Smith River, which is one of the best salmon steelhead streams on the West Coast, essential to the whole Smith River Basin, which is Crescent City's water supply and many, many other things. They take issue with setting aside those water rights so that we cannot have massive nickel strip mines by foreign corporations at the headwaters. And I don't think that's right. And so it would be great if we could communicate directly with them. So I usually recommend that people try to find whoever the local representative is of these organizations and go see them or talk with them and try to start a dialogue. Typically, we find that if we can really talk to one another, our differences aren't as great as we think. And my guess is, in this case, the Farm Bureau's problem doesn't have anything to do, really, with the North Fork of the Smith River and our need to protect it from foreign mining corporations. My guess is their gripe is that they think if they give an inch, we will take a mile. If they give up a crumb of water rights toward in-stream uses rather than commodity uses, including farming, of course, that then there'll be this avalanche of pressure on them, and that's simply not true. We are simply trying to protect the very best that's left, and in fact, there's really no farming or irrigation potential in that river basin at all.
That's why it was surprising when you mentioned Farm Bureau taking an interest in this.
Yeah. So that's my advice to you, Harvey.
Harvey, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk more with Tim Palmer. He is the author of Rivers of Oregon, author and photographer, the photographer for America's great national forests, wildernesses, and grasslands, written by Char Miller. And you can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 as we talk about wildlands over the phone. Tell us about some places that you are really fond of and would like to see preserved if they're not preserved already. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Which brings us to the guest opinion you published in the Oregonian published of yours on September 29th about public lands. What was the gist of what you said there?
Well, you know, the public land is the best thing we have going in the West. And you know, these are the places that we all own. They're open to everybody to hike, to fish, to hunt, to drive, to paddle, to ski, you name it. And they're out our back door. It's this outdoor recreation and natural paradise that we have simply by living here in Southern Oregon and in the West. Phenomenally valuable. Over 600 million people a year visit our federal public lands alone. And so they're really important to a lot of people. Yet, there is a movement afoot by some Western politicians to do what they call take back federal land. Well, number one, you cannot do that. These lands were always federal lands. That is, after we took them away from the Indians. They were never in private ownership. They've always been public land. So you can't take them back. What you can do is take them away from all of us who own them. And so I really try to make the point that our public land is valuable to all of us. It's what makes living in the West and in Oregon a really special place. These lands are vital to our water quality, to our fisheries, to many aspects of life here. We need to protect them. We need to regard our federal lands as our own because that's what they really are.
You've been out of the landscape for a long time, though, Tim. I mean, what would you gauge as the current strength and interest in the Take Back the Land movement? I know you're referencing, at least in part, the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge takeover of last winter, the trial going on in Portland right now, and that was mentioned in your column in the Oregonian. But, by whatever name, Sagebrush Rebellion or Take Back the Land movement, does it appear to be stronger now or a bit weaker than in recent years?
Let me tell you, you hear a lot about this in some circles, and even the Republican National Party platform calls for privatizing federal land, and even our county commissioners, I went to our candidates forum here a while back, and virtually every person running for county commissioner said they support less federal land.
That's in Curry County.
So in Curry County, right. Yeah. So you do hear about it, but I really think that view is limited to those limited groups. And for every, I see 100 people enjoying our public land estate for every one that I hear complaining about too much federal land. I think that the resource industries have they have a well-funded movement to promote this idea of privatizing public land, because that way they can get their hands on it more easily. And I think our county commissioners, many of them see the federal estate as a way that they can balance their sad budgets for the next year. And yet we need to look to other means to do both of those things. And if as soon as we start talking about taking this land away from all of us who own it, I personally become very alarmed. And even though I think it's a minor movement overall and an extremely small part of the population that thinks this way, nonetheless, there is political talk of it, and so we have to address it.
Tim Palmer, author and photographer, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He spends a lot of time in the outdoors taking pictures of some of the beautiful places. So we're talking about those as portrayed in two books he is a part of, including his own Rivers of Oregon just out. You can join us on the Exchange. Get into the conversation about wild and public lands and what the proper and best use of those is. If you'd like to see some conversion, and if so, conversion from what to what, 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Reading your column yesterday set me off in a different direction. I wasn't sure if you're aware that there's a conference of Western Attorneys General that actually is chaired by Ellen Rosenblum, the Oregon Attorney General, that looked into any legal basis that might exist for the idea of taking federal land into private or state hands, and didn't find a doctrine that would work.
Right. Well, that doesn't surprise me. And one of the things that those advocates do claim is that they really just want to convert land from federal to maybe to state ownership. But look no further than the Elliott State Forest to see what will happen in that scenario. We have a state forest here. It's a beautiful place near Coos Bay. And the state is now planning to sell it or get rid of it because they don't want to take care of it anymore. So that is the scenario we face if these lands go into state ownership. But yes, I'm not familiar with what the attorneys general really did or said, but I'm not surprised that they found no basis for a movement to convert these lands.
Yeah, it's an interesting report that came out in July. We're hoping to do some work on that soon. As much time as you spend outdoors, Tim, you must run into people with some very different values for public land and some very different ideas of how it's used.
Well, actually, I really don't when I'm outdoors. When I'm outdoors, I find people who are enjoying our public land. But of course, in other venues, I do find people with differing opinions on that. There's substance to almost everybody's, there is substance to everybody's legitimate point of view. And one is that maybe these lands should be open to more resource extraction use. So, but let's just look at the numbers. One of the typical points of criticism is the amount of land in wilderness. People say there's way too much wilderness. Well, in fact, only 2% of America is protected as wilderness, which is not much for the land that's set aside just because it's natural, just because it was made that way, and just because we intend to keep it that way, as opposed to the rest of the land, which might be developed or logged or mined or dammed or roaded or whatever. Only 2%. In Oregon, it's only 4%, which is way less than all the states surrounding us. So, you know, that's really not much. So I do hear people say too much wilderness, but when you really look at the numbers, you know, in any kind of sense of equitable fairness or apportionment of our resources for use, it's not very much.
I was struck by some of the individual stories of people whose opinions on this have changed over the years. In fact, I ran across one of the pictures in Char Miller's book with your photographs, America's Great National Forests, Wildernesses, and Grasslands. There's a picture of Jim Rogers, who I think is a neighbor of yours in Port Orford. He was a logger, and if he's the same Jim Rogers I know, I met him years ago when he was working on protecting the Elk River.
Yeah, that's Jim.
No,
Jim is our main, our natural resource conscience here in the Elk River Basin. And he had a whole career in the timber industry. His job was to identify the forests to be cut and to see that they were cut efficiently. And he did that for, I don't know, about 20 years. He personally oversaw the clear cutting of 20,000 acres of old growth forest. And somewhere in that process, he said, wow, this is out of control. This is way too much. He's looking at what was left, what had been cut. He realized that in the Coast Range alone of Oregon, 95 to 98% of the old growth had been cut. The clock was running out on what was left. What was left is essential to not only our fisheries, like our salmon runs because they need clean streams, but to other species of wildlife and to people who use these lands. So he kind of jumped ship and went to the other side and became this diehard conservationist leading the effort to protect what's left of the Elk River Basin. And again, that's not all Southern Oregon, just the Elk River. Mm-hmm. But if you fly over Oregon and especially the Coast Range, you'll see that it's kind of, and this is not just opinion, this is fact. You look down at the ground and it's a checkerboard of clear cuts and logged areas and a checkerboard with most of those blanks having been cut. One area where that is not true is the Elk River. It's the one piece that's left that's largely unlogged and mostly pristine. So Jim, dedicated the rest of his life to seeing that at least 20,000 acres would be permanently protected. And he made that grade with the Copper Salmon Wilderness designation in 2009.
I think I'm familiar with about a third of your catalog. Have you done any work documenting what has been done to the landscape? I mean, you take gorgeous photographs of the wild spaces, but have you done much work photographing clear cuts, for example?
You know, I do a lot of that, Jeffrey, and not just clear cutting, but, you know, the land development, the mining, you know, and other things, the diversions of water where streams are totally dried up. I have a huge inventory of these pictures that show the effects of short-sighted management. But, you know, in the books, I think people want only a little bit of that, if any. You don't want to live with photographs of that stuff. You need to know it's happening. But when it comes to inspiring people and encouraging people to go out and to be involved and to take responsibility for their place, the first emotion that I feel you need to have is a sense of love of this place. And I think we get that by seeing nature as it is and just the remarkable complexity and beauty and all the essential, realizing about all the essential interworkings of nature. I think we need to realize that first to become committed to taking care of our planet. After that, I think we need a sense of outrage at what's happening to it, and that's where the ugly pictures come in. But I don't think people really want a whole book of that when they go look for something to buy on the bookshelf.
You give a defense of the Forest Service in the photography notes in the back of America's Great National Forests, Wildernesses, and Grasslands. What do you see that has happened at the Forest Service?
Well, this has been an embattled agency, of course, for years, and one of the most one of the most treasured agencies of the federal government historically. From its beginning under Teddy Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot, this was the agency that took care of our public lands. And, you know, the rangers are out there on the ground, and it just had a great image. But then the agency, after an initial phase of kind of caretaking but not active involvement, it became captured by the timber industry after World War II. And almost all the National Forest land was being logged. Only beginning in the 70s was the movement to protect a little bit of what's left introduced. And, of course, that then gained credence and stature as the agency itself saw what was needed to manage these lands in perpetuity. So the Forest Service has changed in big ways in recent years.
All right, much more to talk about with Tim Palmer. He's got a couple of new books out. We'll talk about public lands and how they're used as well, and take phone calls and emails from you. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Tim Palmer from Port Orford, who... Well, the easiest way to say this is he's written more than 20 books that celebrate the natural spaces around us, from the rivers of Oregon to the Field Guide to California rivers to American rivers. You get it. There's a bunch of attention on rivers. He's got the new Rivers of Oregon out. That's his own book. He's also the photographer for a book by Char Miller called America's Great National Forest, Wildernesses, and Grasslands. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about wild spaces and their preservation and the particular role of public lands in preserving public spaces. 800-838-3760 for your phone calls. Your emails go to jx@jeffnet.org. Let's see. We have an email here from Bruce in Happy Camp. He says, we all have to pay attention to our public lands. If we don't, they can be abused, especially keeping an eye on federal agencies like the Department of Agriculture and the Bureau of Land Management. They manage, but do not own them. We do, says Bruce in Happy Camp.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And related to that, Jeffrey, let me just go back to your last question. I didn't have quite the time to really answer it about the Forest Service.
Sure.
So I really want to commend this agency today, not for agreeing with me, they don't, not for doing everything I think they should be doing, they don't, but for striving for balance. You know, for years, the forests were overcut. The mining law of 1872 is still in effect, which prioritizes mining. They're under all kinds of pressures, and the people who are there today, I think, are just doing a great job and working as hard as they can to achieve balance within the whole panoply of laws regulating what they do, and the whole diversity of opinions of the people that they hear from. Their job is to balance all of this out. And I just can't say more about how much I appreciate them engaging in that really difficult work.
Do you have a particular opinion about the proposed expansion of the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument? I know there's a meeting in Ashland this week to talk about the designation.
There is. And, you know, that area of our state is really special. I mean, it's this meeting ground of four different major ecosystems. And, you know, there's tremendous diversity of wildlife and habitat there. And much of it is public land now. There's a mixture of private land, which is unaffected by the proposal. And I think it's a good thing. I think that an added layer of protection for that area because it is so unique biologically, is really an important thing to do.
Let's take a call. We have John in Vinita on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer, author and photographer.
Good morning, guys.
Hi.
Hey, speaking to my heart, I was just kind of describing to the young lady, you know, I worked for the Willamette from like 69 to mid-70s. And by the way, I did do a lot of prescribed burning.
Uh-huh. Willamette National Forest?
Yes, Willamette. And actually, early on, it was some of the units were over 100 acres, and then they passed a law, I think, towards the end of my tenure, about 32 acres, if I remember correct. But nonetheless, they were just raping our forests. They were ripping them down. This is coming from fifth-generation logging family. That's me. It was killing me to see this. They kept inventing better equipment, faster, better wham. They just take down, this 30-acre square in no time at all. It was just amazing. And these are huge trees. So what I always try to get people to really think about is, I do not like the term old growth, because we're cutting third generation trees now in places. And by the way, I'm not completely against the lumber industry, that's for damn sure. But old growth can mean what you want it to, so you get people talk by each other. And I've said this on this show many times. You say virgin timber, it describes what it is. And I don't believe that any virgin timber that's left should be allowed to be cut down. What Tim is saying about flying over, that's what I tell people. If you don't believe what's happened, get in a small plane and go for a ride. When you look down, you will go, whoa. You might have to have it explained to you, because it's if you've never been up. Mm. But I was in Hell Attack, I was initial attack and all that. I get to see it a lot. And we don't have very much left, and it's completely different than second growth. Everything about it, the character of the lumber even. The lumber is worth more than premium heart cherry. I'm a cabinet maker, I can tell you that. Vertical fir, clear vertical fir, or CVG they call it. So there's a real incentive to get to it, but it won't come back. We will never have it again. Virgin timber, when it's gone, it is gone.
All right, thanks for the thoughts there, John. Appreciate that. Tim, your thoughts back?
Yeah. I think John, the nail you've hit on the head here is the issue of scarcity. And, it's not that any of us are against logging. It's against the idea of logging the very last that's left of old growth. And, we're down to 10% of that in Oregon. In the West, we're down to about 1% to 5% of that in the Coast Range. And, so what we have left, it's worth protecting that little bit that we have left. And, of course, we need to effectively manage the rest and not have logging right up to the edges of our streams, to have effective buffers, which, by the way, our state forest management practices law does not require on private industry lands, and we've got plenty of those being cut. It does have a buffer requirement, but it's not nearly adequate to protect the streams and the rest of the environment. So we need to protect the little bit of old growth that's left. We need to better manage and do a better job at logging what remains. And I think a lot of people in the timber industry agree with that.
It's been rather an Oregon-centric discussion thus far, but I'm reminded, as I flip particularly through the book for which you're the photographer, America's Great National Forests, Wildernesses, and Grasslands, that you have been far beyond the West. I mean, for one, how many photographs have you taken by now? Do you have any way of knowing what the number is? And
I don't, Jeffrey, but, for that book alone, I shot 16,000 photos.
16,000, wow.
For the National Forest book, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, immediately I throw away about three-quarters of them. But yeah, I've shot a lot of pictures. But photography, and this is why I do it, and this is why I like to think people will benefit from having my books. Photography is the next best thing to going there. Of course, there's nothing like being there and experiencing these places, and that's really my ultimate goal, is to get people to go out and learn about their places firsthand. But the next thing is a photo that shows the remarkable beauty of what we have, and that's the purpose of my involvement in the National Forest book, and just as much or more so my new Rivers of Oregon book. Photography, being a photographer, requires me to see better. You can go out and you can just look around, and that's great. But if you're taking a picture, you have to really notice more things and read the landscape and look for the telling details and the big themes and think about the kind of image that will really convey the importance of this place, and not just what nature is, but what nature does with the weather and the changes in the flow of water and the incoming storms and the fires and all of that. And that's what really, that's what really motivates me about photography and about doing these photo books. And it's what I hope will appeal and be important to other people too.
This is not just the 1/125th of a second either. I'm thinking that you probably spend hours at some of these places waiting for the light and the weather conditions that you just mentioned to get right.
That's right. That's right. I don't change my photos after I take them. So I'm a little different than virtually everybody else in the photo industry today. I want to show things as they are. And so I don't adjust my photos. I do minor changes for aperture, for the light, or to get accurate color, but I don't change the content of anything. But I do look for the most beautiful scene I can find. And so that means getting up early for that sunrise light, or missing dinner to get the sunset light. you know, or going out in bad weather when the storms are brewing and you have those beautiful, dark, stormy skies overhead, or going out in the snow when everything is just crystal and white. And, you know, so I try to get the most beautiful photos I can, but I don't really manipulate the photos afterwards.
No photoshopping for you, huh?
No, not really. Just the, as I said, just the minor changes for light and to get the color right.
We have an email from Barbara in Grants Pass. I think I know which Barbara. She writes, I wonder if Tim can talk about the connection here between our rivers, the clean, clear water, and the wild salmon and steelhead they provide, and their national forest watersheds. We have something here that few places in the country has, rivers that remain pretty much as they have been for millennia. So please talk about why protecting our wild and scenic rivers like the Smith, Illinois, Chetco, and Elk mean protecting the National Forest and BLM watersheds, their source and home.
Yeah.
Again, that from Barbara in Grants Pass.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, I've traveled the whole country. I've been doing river work for 40 years, and I think I can say with some authority on this issue that there is absolutely nothing like what we have here in southwestern Oregon in terms of our rivers estate. We have more great wild rivers and important rivers for the natural ecosystem than any place. And so we've got to protect them. You know, the from the Elk and the Coquille down through the rivers of Northern California, there is no other concentration like this in America. And so it's appalling that we would be facing the threats that we are, for example, from foreign corporations to strip mine for nickel at the headwaters of the Rogue River via the Illinois and Rough and Ready Creek, the headwaters of the North Fork of the Pistol, which runs straight into the ocean, the headwaters of the Smith River, which is so important to Oregon and even more so to Northern California. We have these strip mines proposed right in the middle of this region of the most exceptional rivers. And so we just got to get a grip here and protect these places in the way that they deserve so that they are not ruined the way so many other rivers and other areas are. And all you have to do is look across the West or look at EPA's data on mining waste and on hazardous waste and the toxic waste of mining, and the abandoned mines were immense problems costing billions of dollars in total are left to the American taxpayers. We don't want that to happen here. We should protect these rivers instead.
There is congressional action, we should remind folks, that is underway to withdraw from the potential for mining the lands you specify along the North Fork, Smith, the Pistol, and the Rough and Ready Creek at a minimum, I believe.
That's right. And this is a relatively modest proposal that would protect these streams. I mean, we're not talking about banning panning for gold mining or anything like that. What this would do is protect these streams from the kind of major mining proposals and new mines that are the basis of the threats that we now face.
Well, let's get our heads completely out of the West Coast for just a minute, because you do have a fair amount of stuff in the Forests and Grasslands book from Eastern Forests, and I just wonder how radically different they may be from what we have out here, particularly since they've probably been cut over several times.
Yeah, it is way different, and the history is different. You know, in the West, these are lands that were always in public ownership, as I said, that presidents like Republican Theodore Roosevelt set aside because he didn't want every place to be subdivided and clear-cut and so forth. In the East, it's very different. The lands there, you know, were settled in the 1700s, and so pretty much all of the land was consumed in that way. And so the national forests there more reflect an effort to restore cut over and otherwise used up lands, primarily from the Great Depression era when so many landowners went into default. The Dust Bowl area, which was obliterating our grasslands. Back then, many of these national forests were established in order to restore the natural systems and the economic systems of timber production and whatnot. And so these lands were bought from private landowners who had gone into default or were willing to sell to the federal government to assemble the network of national forests we have now in the East. Very different from what we have in the West. And let me point out, there are 38 states in America that have nominal land in public ownership. Those of us in the West are the ones who really have this great benefit. Those other states, including the eastern states with the national forest, really don't have very much of this. And the people there hunger for more. And so there are big efforts and very expensive efforts to buy yet more land there to provide these public needs that our federal lands do.
Tim Palmer, just a couple of seconds for this answer. For all the places you visited, is there a place besides Port Orford that calls to you over and over?
Oh gosh, there's so many. You know, I can't answer that. But you know, people always ask me what my favorite river is, and it troubles me. And usually I end up saying the river where I am. So I think today it would be the Rogue River Basin.
All right.
From headwaters to the ocean.
All right. Tim Palmer's latest solo book is called Rivers of Oregon, and he's also the photographer for Char Miller's book, America's Great National Forests, Wildernesses, and Grasslands. He'll be in Ashland at the Standing Stone Brewery Monday at 6. Tim, always a pleasure to talk to you.
I'd love to see you all Monday night. It's a pleasure to talk with you, Jeffrey.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.